Welcome to the El Arpa podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk. Welcome to the El Arpa podcast. Joining me in studio is Mary. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
You look resplendent with the shine of this Yeti microphone casting its gaze upon you.
I'm very happy we have a new microphone.
Yeah, we certainly do. If you liked our last microphone, this is pretty tasty. This is the blue Yeti microphone, and it is the one that a lot of YouTubers use for their podcasts and their videos and everything like that. So anyway, you're shaking your head. Am I abusing the microphone?
You don't have to be very close.
Okay.
And you don't have to be on top of it. You can talk to it from the side.
I shouldn't be like a helicopter podcaster.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
okay. You can just talk normally.
Fair enough. But anyway, well, it's good we have the dials here, because I always hear on other podcasts when the sound levels look low. So I can actually tell you, backed up by stats, to come closer to the microphone. While in other episodes, it was more of a vague feeling.
Okay. Well, yeah. The whole point of buying this microphone is so I don't have to shout and I can just use my normal quiet voice.
Yeah. So I promised you an anthropological question.
Okay.
Are you ready for it?
No.
To kick off part one. Well, you might have seen the story of the American preacher in the Bay of Bengal. Have you seen that story?
I don't think so.
Well, there's a remote island where it's like, is a 3,000-year-old civilization, and he was there to bring Jesus to this tribe. And if you read the story without dates, it seems like something from the 1700s. Even like Martin Scorsese's movie Silence, you have this, I think, setback in the past, you know. So it's like, it's something that it seems like from a lost era. But anyway, so like this week he went there to try and convert them to Christianity. But the thing is, they're very resistant to outsiders. Even the British couldn't conquer them. And the Indian government tried to bring him back into conventional society, but said, okay, they're not playing ball. This is very, very difficult. And there's an exclusion zone around the island, so they can live there uninterrupted. And basically, they leave them alone. Now, this poor guy, this is a tragic story. He was killed by them. He went to the islands and, like, he had some contact with them. They were shouting at him in their language. He was trying to mimic them, and they were laughing at him. And then he kind of withdrew and then came back again. And the second time he came back, he was hit by a volley of arrows and killed. Now, the body is very hard to get because, like, the police aren't allowed there. It is a murder, but also there's no jurisdiction there. And you need anthropologists, you need, like, special type of people to kind of broach them and get access to it, because it's a place that's very hard to get to, not in terms of geography, but because there's so much protection around it and the people there are so resistant to the outside world that going there can be very dangerous, you know, for the people involved. So his body is still there, and we don't know if it can be recovered or if it'll be recovered like soon, you know. So, okay, that's kind of like a sad story. So obviously, you know, for his family and everything like that, and for the poor man who lost his life, it's a very sad event. From an anthropological perspective, you have dealt with people who are on the margins of society, who aren't, like, directly involved, I guess, a little bit, in kind of the conventional society, people who are maybe parts of, or have continued a long-standing tradition and haven't gone with the modern world, with your experiences in Egypt, no?
Yes, yeah. I would say so.
So we're going to talk about, like, tradition in the second part of the show. So there is a kind of link between these two things. But, what is it, do you think, that keeps them kind of in those traditions? Now, that's not to say or to infer that that's a wrong thing to do, like looking for a justification for why they would persist in it. But it is unusual in the sense that most people don't do it anymore. So You have this tribe who are exceptional because they're so resistant to the outside world, but also you have places like Egypt that you have direct experience of, where people are kind of maybe more resistant to the modern world. Do you know why that is?
Well, in the case of Egypt, I won't say they're more resistant to the modern world. It's a mixture because,
yeah,
like on the one hand, there are ways of life in the villages, which of course are quite, I don't know, almost like pre-industrial. And then you have traditions and you have habits that probably you wouldn't find in Europe, or things that, you know, there used to be in Europe that there isn't any longer. Then on the other hand, these people are exposed to actually lots of, just pretty much the same influences as everybody else. They might not get, I don't know, the latest fashion, but they do get the news, and, well, they might not have a very good internet, but they are aware of more or less of what's going on in the world. I remember once in a very remote village where there was absolutely nothing and nobody had anything, and they were discussing like the latest thing that the United States had said about Israel. So, and it was news, like fresh news. So in that respect, like, there was a connection. But then the tribe that you were talking about, then I think, I mean, that's very rare now, and I think it just, like, geography definitely plays a really big role there in keeping them, you know, isolated. But also the size of the human group, because it's a lot easier when a group is small. It's a lot easier to not to be, like, you know, infected by external influences or anything like that.
Yeah, because the reason I was making the comparison between the tribe in the Bay of Bengal and Egypt, for example, is that very often, even in European countries, when you have people of a certain territory, even like in France, for example, people speaking a version of French from the north of the country, very often are brought into line with what the centre views as being French or whatever nationality, you know. So I guess you kind of hit the nail on the head there. Excuse me. I'm just kind of like...
Press mute. This is our new functionality.
Oh, really? Oh, wow. Okay. Yes. That's good, actually. I was kind of half burping there anyway. So I'll mute that in the future. But yeah, so like these tribes who wouldn't really be promoted within Egypt, they're kind of on the second rung of the ladder in a lot of respects, no?
The Egyptian... Well, they're not tribes, but...
Okay,
yeah,
sorry.
Like, well, populations that, perhaps because they're in remote rural areas, they're not really, they're completely forgotten about, yeah.
Yeah, but you're also talking about the people before whose mud houses have been, like, the Egyptian government have rode roughshod over...
Oh, you're talking about the Nubians, yes.
The Nubians, yeah that's what I'm referring to.
They're bigger than a tribe, but yes.
Yeah.
Yeah,
You're splitting anthropological hairs with me. No,
sorry.
It's important.
No, but yeah, it is important because obviously it's a different, like, organization stage. So.
But, like, you know, they're not, like, what I'm trying to say is because there's nowhere from the go or to be cut off from the rest of Egypt, they've been, I guess, brought into a more homogenous group, no?
This is what I was getting at before, that, you know, the tribe that you're talking about is isolated, and that's, like, isolation is, like, hugely important for preservation of traditions, for sure.
That is true, but also, again, in the modern world, and we'd have to look into the story more about why the Indians and the British before them couldn't actually bridge that divide, because, in a sense, in the modern world, there is no remoteness. So it's a very peculiar situation why this has kind of persisted here. But nevertheless, I thought it was just a fascinating story, really, from this week, because again, it's from another world.
Sounds like something completely from another world in another era, really.
And it's always a funny thing, you know, because for some people, obviously, he's very deeply held convictions, you know, and for other people, you know, if he hadn't gone there, he'd still be alive. But it's a very complex one. But nevertheless, traditions are what we're talking about in part two. A bit cheerier. And we have to we'll make a special mention in part two. But we'll be talking about traditions and you're Spanish, you say it.
La movida, ah, ya, la movida, ya, in general. Para
Yeah.
los movida madrileña es, well, because it started in Madrid.
Yeah, went to Barcelona, Vigo, and maybe Bilbao.
Yeah.
But really, it was a Madrid phenomenon. And we'll be talking about that and the reaction of your parents to these strange young people
They're gonna become famous.
back in the 80s. Okay, well, join us momentarily for that, and we'll be with you shortly. Okay, so welcome to part two of the show, and our special shout out goes to Barry, our friend from West Limerick, who gave us the idea for
Who wrote that letter to the program?
yes, he's a competition winner. He's currently in hospital with a broken leg. He was playing the under sevens football tournament in West Limerick, and he hurt himself for celebrating too much after scoring the winning goal. So Barry, you little champ, hope you get better soon. All the best from the Unwrapped podcast. And the teddy bear is coming your way as well, so don't worry. So thank you very much, man, for giving us this idea for La Movida Madrileña. And who better to talk about it, or to start talking about it, than a woman from, well, near Madrid.
Oh no. You've got that very wrong.
Well, it's in the same country, at least.
Yeah, it's in the same country. No, I think it's better from a person that is not from Madrid, because then, you know, a country bumpkin that was coming into the capital just at the time of the movida.
Yeah, well, it is a huge cultural phenomenon. I guess what happened in the 60s in America and United Kingdom, and maybe in France as well, happened in Spain in the 80s. Would that be a fair
Yeah,
summation?
I think that's what most people say.
But it's kind of strange though, because like in the 60s, people always think of the 60s as this one homogenous decade, you know, where this is happening from 19. As soon as the clock turned and the calendar turned, it was the 1st of January 1960 until December 31st, 1969. It was just a whole decade of this, you know. But it's kind of more diffuse, slow building revolution as well, because obviously this transition between the Moors of the 50s and I guess the modern world in a way, you know, it was taking place over the course of that decade, over the course of those 10 years. So even by 64 and 65, you know, you had people still living or hadn't really been fully immersed in this great cultural revolution. So where I'm going with this is that, first of all, is a very diffuse movement that took 10 years to kind of develop as well. But the Movida Madrileña seems, from my outsider's perspective, to be, well, first of all, it's unique because it has almost a definite starting point, and not just Franco's debt, really, and another thing that we'll touch on in a moment, but almost like from when it started, there's no build up. It's just intense from the very first moment. That's my impression of it anyway, from the outside looking in and looking backwards. So I think in those two ways, it's quite different from that as well. Even though that would be the common association, the framework around which we try and understand it as a cultural phenomenon, it was like from 0 to 100 instantly and for the entire duration of the Movida, I think, no?
Yes, I would agree with that. I think obviously there's a detonant, which is like the end of the dictatorship, and that's probably one of the reasons why it's more concentrated. But yes, Spain has been opening up, kind of like from the 70s into like the rest of Europe, basically, and then by that time, you know, especially like punk culture, and that is already like taking place.
Well, yeah, that's true. Yeah, because we kind of said it was like the 60s, but in fact, of course, I mean, they were modeling themselves on the mods and rockers and the punks of contemporary
Well, in terms
Britain.
of, yeah, in terms of like you know, the whole breaking up with tradition, or I think your comparison is a fair one with the 60s. In terms of the actual trends, then it would be comparable with the other trends at the time in other countries. But I think that's one of the reasons why what you were saying is true about how it's like very focused on a few years, because it's kind of like, it's like opening the door and then everything that is happening outside can start happening here.
It's a weird comparison as well. Well, not weird, but I mean, in one sense, it's a huge reaction to the, I guess, suffocating climate of the dictatorship, which, as you mentioned, was lessening anyway, but still, I'm sure, pretty restrictive. So, in one sense, I mean, if you look at the British punks, they were reacting against conservatism, Thatcherism, austerity as well, maybe, you know, and all these things in Britain that they didn't agree with politically. And in a way, you know, even though the stakes weren't as high, maybe, but like someone like Johnny Rotten and the Sex Pistols, and they're kind of like two fingers to the establishment back when it kind of meant something, had such a power, even though, you know, it's not, it kind of seems like it's less significant than what was happening in Spain because they're coming out of a dictatorship. But what they were doing in Britain is also pretty weighty, because I guess if you were a punk rocker, in the eyes of the state and the police, you were, I guess, scum as well. So I don't know, how comparable do you think those two situations are?
I think, to be honest, there is more of what you're saying of like something against the establishment than actually against the dictatorship, you know, because I think what we're talking about, because obviously after the last few years of the dictatorship and right after the dictatorship, the end of the 70s, there are a lot of, like, for example, some writers that are kind of like picking up on a lot of social issues, but it's a different thing, you know? While then when you start with La Movida, a lot of the issues I feel that touch on things like, you know, especially like punk, for example, they have a common denominator. So that's what I meant, that I don't think it's like a delayed reaction like it would have happened in another context, but it's actually opening up and just picking up what is happening without any delay. It's actually, you know, for once being exactly at the same time as what is happening elsewhere. Because obviously, for example, in the 60s, what we've talked about, everything that occurs doesn't happen in Spain. All that revolution, all that kind of like, you know.
But it's just, if I try and explain it in another way as well, it's hard for me in a way to not understand it, but maybe I'm trying to link these two things that in many ways can't be linked, because like, I think also part of the Movida was almost like a sexual liberation as well, or it's kind of like an opening up of attitudes, while in Britain that probably happened in the 60s. And in another way as well, like, I just feel, no, that's kind of my main point for now. We'll go into more stuff, but you're going to react to that as well.
Well, I think what you said is based on the fact that legally, for example, is when like it becomes, for example, a contraceptive become legal.
Yeah.
Well, a whole lot of like things that before were unthinkable. So in that sense, yes, there was a delay in Spain, but that kind of like maybe sexual opening or, you know, like a bigger acceptance of like things like drugs come from a much larger tolerance in that moment than there was before because of the political situation and like the moral climate, basically.
Yeah, that is true. Speaking of the drugs, like Barry, little guy in hospital, hope you get better. No, he was saying that he knows like stories of people who were alive and in Madrid at this time, and you know, it wasn't all glamour. I mean, a lot of you know, drugs and kind of social situations or economic situations that weren't very nice for a lot of people. I wonder, did the lyrics of many songs reflect that kind of social reality? And was it like a commentary on conservative politics? Because I know, based on our Lava PS book that we've mentioned before as well, you know, this kind of new politics was something that was very much part of people's lives and wanting those politicians to change things for the better socially. I guess if you look at bands from the 80s in Britain, even the Specials, for example, and other groups, their lyrics would have been quite politicized against the conservatism of the Thatcher government, for example. So, but by your expression, I'm guessing no.
Well, it's because, you know, that's why when you were asking me before about, the 60s or the 70s, you know, I can think off the top of my head of like some writers, like for example, the group that that of three some writers that Joaquin Sabina studied with.
Yeah,
they were like, you know, political critique like through and through, and that was the end of the 70s, or all throughout the 70s, you know. And that was much more, well, then they were complaining about NATO, they were like, you know,
kind of like a
they went into like proper political issues,
like an international left almost, you know, that
it was very much about like, well, for example, they have a song where they complain about how the Spanish president, who's the first socialist president after the dictatorship, the first president indeed, that he got us into NATO. So, for example, they complain about how hypocritical it is that a socialist would get us into NATO. That's not La Movida, though, you know? La Movida is later on.
Yeah.
And then the themes are far more, to me, as in, you know, we are not like slaves to the state or like... But more in terms of like, we are the owners of our own body and we are the owners of our own... lives, and we can do with them whatever we want, which is kind of different, I think.
I know, I think you're right. And also in Spain, I guess, if it's a reaction to things that happened before, and mentioning Sabine and other writers and poets of other generations, I think, you know, in the Civil War, also the 27 generation, you have a long legacy of writers talking about very explicitly political things. So I guess maybe there wasn't such a need for it either in La Movida, because it's something that had been articulated so many times in Spanish history, you know?
See, the thing is, I'm not sure whether there's so much an interest in politics as... And I'm talking here, especially the stuff in Madrid, because then there's another thing, which is like Basque rock, for example, which was also an important part of La Movida. And I think that's much more political.
Yeah.
But when we're talking, for example, about famous like groups here, like, I don't know, it could be Alaska or things like that.
Well, we have Nacha Pop, Alaska.
Yeah.
Las Pegamoides.
Alaska y Los Pegamoides is the same.
Oh, sorry. Paraíso, Mama, yeah. Las Bolidos, Trastos, Mario Tenia, and Los Solitarios y Mermelada.
Yeah, I mean...
We'll talk about these, don't worry, at the end. We'll finish on a light note and we'll kind of reference those bands in more detail, but you're going to say something about them anyway, which you can do, of course.
No, I was going to say that if you listen to the lyrics, like, for example, Alaska, you know, it's like things like... for example, one of the most famous songs is like, you know, I'm dancing all day and like, you know, basically screw the neighbors if they don't like the fact that my music is loud. For example,
right? Yeah, I guess it's kind of like punk, which is kind of like just two fingers up to everybody, and you know, what do you want.
Yeah. And so, in fact, for example, yesterday I read an enlightening definition of La Movida, written by one of the protagonists, that was saying that it was kind of like an acknowledgement of the present to completely reject it and move on from there. You know, so there isn't a political interest from my point of view, like trying to, you know, focus on the Spanish reality.
Yeah, it is a rupture from...
It's a detachment, I think, in a way. You know?
It's interesting that you say that, because what we can talk about here just for a little bit is theory, philosophical theory, and, well, psychological theory about traditions and their function in society. And so there was this test. Well, before I look at, I talk about the test. Like a definition of of tradition is that when traditions take place on a regular basis, I am reading this. stream of consciousness. They bring predictability and constancy to our lives. In addition to the nurturance and pleasure of communing. I'm making aims of this. They help remove us at least temporarily from the cacophony of the outside world. We get reassurance that we will indeed be all right. Now, I feel like the La Movida is a reaction to tradition gone wrong, which is ironic, because based on this definition of what tradition is, it being a way for us to escape our daily toils and struggles, which, going back to the book that we mentioned in another podcast, The History of Collective Joy, that's why we Carnival, the Maypole, all these festivals, it was a way to kind of like put up with working in the fields and to just lose yourself. I mean, in the Carnival, you'd people playing different characters, men dressing up as women just for the crack of it, and poor pretending to be rich, rich pretending to be poor. You know, these performed a very huge social function for us to kind of escape ourselves just for a moment. But also, to refer to that psychological test, it showed that when people are afraid of being punished, they're more comfortable following tradition. But when they feel like they're going to be rewarded, they are more likely to break with tradition and do something away from tradition. I guess the point that you could extrapolate from that is that tradition is very important, has a huge social component. I don't know, like, in a way, I was kind of thinking that because the tradition and the consensus and the conformity had gone so wrong and became very suffocating, you just have this natural extreme reaction, and then there's a balance and a kind of more normal, typical life that we have now. But again, it's just hard for me to kind of square it. And I guess you don't have to try and square it or place it in a context of other countries. And again, talking about Britain, for example. But so I don't know. Maybe it's pointless trying to do that.
Maybe this is a good moment to talk about my parents.
Well, actually, it would be a great moment, actually, because they do represent the old order.
Yeah.
Exactly. So they, of course, were enamored by this.
No. Well, I think it's quite interesting because I mean, it's a personal anecdote, but obviously my parents like used to live in Madrid, and then they moved to León, which is a provincial town, in like 71, which seems very close to a dictatorship. But then we also have to the end of the dictatorship, but we also have to bear in mind it's not the same Madrid than provincial towns that took a lot longer to, you know, open up. So, for example, like going in 71 and then coming back to Madrid in 87. So all I remember my mom saying when I was little to other people when she was on the phone when we just arrived to Madrid was like, somebody has completely changed. This is not my Madrid. This is all she said when I was little. This is not my Madrid.
Wow.
Because when she left in 71, like, okay, fair enough. It was the end of the dictatorship, but her way of life was still very much like it used to be in the 50s.
Yeah.
And yeah, things were opening up, but yeah, okay, like, you know, my dad would get chased by the police or whatever at university, things like that. But, you know, it wasn't like kind of like, I mean, the social order was still like pretty much intact. It wasn't like in 87 where everything was like the complete world was upside down from their point of view.
Yeah.
And then it's when they were seeing all these like punks that we were talking about the other day. Yeah. With the color crest and the Hare Krishna and all this. And for her, she was I remember her like being like generally upset.
Yeah.
And in a way, they really blamed like the government, the local government, because I think one of the strange characteristics of La Movida was that it was very much supported by the local government and encouraged.
Yeah.
To the point that there are famous speeches where basically the mayor of the town encourages people to take drugs and, you know, and to take drugs and like have sex and have fun and go partying and, you know, like lose their heads and be young and all this. And then,
yeah,
for, well, you can imagine like the shock that was going from a society, you know, where like people cannot book a hotel if they're not married.
Yeah.
To a society where somebody is telling you, well, you know, take drugs, sleep around, experiment, all these things.
Yeah, well, I think, well, I mean, I guess in a way they're victims because they just weren't ready for it and it wasn't their time.
Well, they were just too old for it, you see.
Yeah, exactly,
like,
yeah. I mean,
the families and everything, like, he was too late for them.
There's a great scene in Easy Rider, which is a Peter Fonda movie with Dennis Hopper, where they're also in a kind of country town in America, and they're also the object of ridicule. We should have muted that as well.
I know, but you were talking, so we would have missed what you were saying.
It was impossible. But speaking of, like, again, this is being a community, for example, there's a quote here from Diego Manrique. Do you know this guy?
No.
Well, he's a journalist working for one of the major stations. And he was like saying here that these groups that were disparate came together, previously isolated, alone, but they kind of came together to form this kind of social movement. That's what happens even in political revolutions, where you've a patchwork of parties or people coming together for one common end, and then it kind of falls apart, or things kind of go back to normal anyway. We mentioned that this has a definite starting point. This would be the concerto. The concert, which was a homage to, you probably know more about this than I do anyway, no? But the band was called what? Caca de Luxe?
Well, I know there were like quite a few groups, and it was like a concert organized by some like engineers, like an engineer faculty.
They have a story here in ABC, and they refer to it as like our new wave. So they're talking about new wave here. So in New Year's Eve 1979, a tragic accident in a car. So a young guy, Kenito, is that a place?
No, that was one of the members. Well, he was like the drummer
of
a band that later on would be Los Secretos, which is one of the most famous groups.
Yeah, so to kind of honor his memory, they had a huge concert. And at this, you had people like Alaska and other kind of very symbolic groups of La Movida. And this is where people typically say, well, this is where it started.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Fact of the day.
Fact of the day.
It's not something like, you know, widely known. Like, for example, this, maybe if you're like older, because these people that we're talking about now, they're on their 50s, 60s.
Yeah.
50s, maybe. But the ones that are still alive.
Yeah.
Because a lot of them, of the groups, have been dying in the past 10 years or so, normally from like
drugs.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll talk a little bit while we have just a little bit more time about some of the bands. So we mentioned Nacha Pop, Alaska, Paraíso, Mama, Las Bolidos, Trastos. My accent is terrible in Spanish, but these groups are very familiar to you. But you told me
some
a story.
Of them.
You told me a story about there's no beach in Madrid.
Yes.
So, what's the story about that?
No, it's just like a song that just, it was, I can't remember where the group were from, but they weren't from Madrid, and in the song they just complained that, you know, Madrid could have this thing and the other, including the Movida, but that there wasn't a beach. At the end of the day, like, come August, there wasn't a beach. So for them, that was like the most important thing. This was kind of like a few groups that were more kind of like tongue-in-cheek, you know, and they were just basically taking the piss a little bit.
Well, that's what I've read as well, that it was just like kind of nonsense for nonsense sake.
Yeah.
Mecano would be one of the bands that kind of were famous outside of Spain, also famous because Penelope Cruz was dating the lead singer at one point. It was in one of their music videos.
I think she became more famous because of that, because at the time she was not famous at all.
Whatever.
She was like a teenager, but fair enough.
This isn't the Penelope Cruz podcast.
No. Yeah. But there's a disagreement about whether Mecano really are kind of like an integral part of La Movida or not.
Oh, really? Yeah. Well, that sounds interesting.
Hmm.
Care to explain?
No, just because, I mean, the music was like, there were themes that were, not that the others were very deep, but it wasn't kind of like, you know, so much breaking with establishment. It was more kind of like leisure and love. And all right, it talked about things, for example, like homosexuality, which is something that had never been dealt with in a song in Spain.
Yeah.
And in fact, I remember it's in one of the most famous songs, and I remember listening to it when I was little, and I just had no idea what he was talking about. But it was kind of like expressed in a subtle way, but it was there for the first time. But they weren't really, you know, it wasn't like, if you asked any kind of like of people that like punk groups, they would think like Mecano were really posh, and, you know, they wouldn't class them as like a part of La Movida. So I guess it depends whether you ask like the purists or the general public, or what you're focusing on, what your definition is.
Well, they're part of the cultural atmosphere, so I think it's hard to say that it warrants part of the Movida. I think it always happens. You have people like Stuart Lee, who is kind of the self-appointed god of, you know, pure left-wing comedy, and he kind of looks down his nose at other people. I think you get that as well within these revolutions, that
yeah,
we are
course.
the the real deal, and you're not. Yeah, so.
Which is strange for Punk, because they shouldn't give
a monkeys.
Yeah, yeah, really? Should they? So, like.
Shouldn't give a monkeys. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, like. Like, it's also other things of the Movida. You had, like, a Cockney variant of Spanish developing in La VPS, and people speaking in a certain patois. So I can't remember the name of what that was. But again, it was just a way of society breaking down and becoming a bit more comfortable, I guess. Like, this kind of rigid hierarchy and this rigid social structure was dissipating quite quickly. Some words have been codified into the official Spanish because of their common usage, but it's not a variant that really is thriving at the moment, I don't think. You know, obviously, you talk about movies as well. Aldemovar would be a great example of La Movida filmmaking, you know. I think it's like anything. It's just so much, it's almost like a mad rush to do things that a lot of it has dated probably very badly, and it wasn't even important because of whether it was a good song or a good movie, but just because it existed. I would imagine
Yeah, I think, I mean, with Almodóvar it was like a real shock, because all of a sudden you have movies where, you know, there's no censorship sorry. Yeah. So you don't have to like worry about any, but then it's kind of like it almost seems as though the movies cannot have any ordinary characters. They all have to be like,
yeah,
they all have to be like society, like outlaws, and you know what I mean. They all have to, they all have to be actively the opposite of
you know,
what tradition is considered to be. Which I think is one of the reasons why later on it can seem like too forced, because Almodóvar has kept on doing those movies well into the 2000s, you know, and sometimes it's a bit like, well, all right, like, you know, you need sort of like a balance of people that are, they're not all like eccentric and...
Well, it's like Tim Burton, you know, it's just like, okay, it's your style, but again...
Yeah, you know? Like, you can only have so many like wacky characters.
Yeah, you know, but then again, I guess, because Ang Lee is kind of famous for like, you know, I've done a superhero movie, okay, here's a musical. It's like, you know, showing off very fat, like, you know, look, I can do every genre under the sun. So I guess you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. But we're going to wrap this up very quickly. But I guess as well, just one final thing we can say is like that probably, looking back, it seems as well probably more intense than it was. There must have been a lot of people who weren't like, you know, like your parents, for example, were appalled by it, but a lot of ordinary people who were just maybe listening to the Meccano cassette, but...
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, my brother. I mean, my brother, like, the most traditional thing ever was listening to Meccano and was listening to many of these groups.
Yeah, so. Well, it seems they kind of paint as like this kind of hedonistic, kind of like the Last Days of Babylon sometimes, I guess. There's probably a lot of people who were just like the music and the fact that they could hang out and be young.
Definitely.
Without really kind of like, you know, smoking and injecting and... consuming, you know, all these different things.
It depends,
but I don't know. But anyway, so that's our kind of little chat about the Movida Madrileña. You can join us in part 3 for our outro and a few housekeeping things. Welcome to, excuse me, part 3 of the show. So the red light is on, we're recording. Thank you for bearing with us for the first 2 parts of the show. So you can take it away from this point, Mary. There's a newly coined, forged, liberated People's Republic of Radio or something. Can you tell me what I'm talking about?
Radio Public.
That's the word. So...
Yeah, Radio Public. You can listen to us on that platform or any other one you like Spotify or iTunes, or we're pretty much on all of them. But if you listen to us on Radio Public, then you help us keep doing what we do best.
It's true. So if you listen to our podcast and you listen to us on Radio Public, you will give us some money. Not you personally, but your listening will provoke the company to support us financially. Anyway, so you can find us on Instagram, YouTube, Tumblr, our website lapramedia.com, and also our blog called Irish Slice of Madrid, where you can find interesting articles about all things political, cultural, social, and historical involving Ireland, Madrid, and the connection between the two. So, Mary, sports? So, you just say bye, don't worry.
Okay, bye.
All right then, well, check in next week for another hot episode of the Elaborate Podcast. For now, bye-bye.
Till then.
The Elaborate Podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk.